Hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Oh, yeah, tech guy time. Your worst nightmare, a geek with his own radio show. This is the show. I crack myself up. This is the show where we talk about technology, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, augmented reality, real reality, all that stuff. Anything with a chip in it. Now, I'm a geek, but you don't have to be to listen to the show. I try to talk in English. I try to translate. Sometimes I succeed. Sometimes I don't. If you say, what did you just say? You can call 8888-ASK-LEO if you have a question. Maybe you want some translation from the geek speak down at the local computer shop. 888-827-5536 is the phone number. The website is techguylabs.com, and you'll see a link there at the website for a chat room, which you can join as well at irc.twit.tv. This is, we call it Team Tech Guy. These are the smart, fine, and above average looking people who convene there to help me with answers to your questions. So when you call, you're asking not just this poor servant of the technological future, but you're also asking them. And they also, they have friends too. So we can get a lifeline if we need to. 8888-ASK-LEO. You like my slide rule? Somebody in the chat room saying, nice slide rule. I bought on eBay one of those big classroom slide rules because it's an artifact of another era. It probably many of you are old enough to remember in the high school math class or maybe the science class, the giant yellow wooden thing hanging about 7 feet long. It was hanging up there, and the teacher would use it to show you how to use a slide rule. Even in my ute, these many years ago, people started around high school getting calculators, but that was a pretty fancy person. A calculator was, $1,000, these calculators in the 70s. Very expensive. Really, actually, these early calculators, including the Hewlett-Packard calculators and the Texas Instrument calculators, were the precursor of the first personal computers. It turned out that, who was it? Maybe it was Texas Instruments. Somebody commissioned Intel to make a cheap calculator chip. Intel was a brand new company at the time, and they made something, I think it was a 4004. They said, we're not so far off from producing a general purpose computing chip. Maybe we ought to do that. We could make inexpensive computers. Well, it wasn't that much longer after that, maybe 5-10 years, that the first personal computers, based on the successor to the 4004, the 8008, and then later the 8080, and then the 8088, were created. And that was the beginning of the computer revolution. But before that, we used what we sometimes colloquially called slipsticks. They were slide rules that took advantage of a kind of clever mathematical hack. Turns out, if you add logarithms of numbers, it's the same as multiplying them. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have gotten into this. So the slide rule added numbers on a logarithmic scale, and in effect did multiplication and division. And it was pretty cool. They weren't very accurate. Actually, slide rules were used to teach something I wish they taught these days. One of the things you learned right away with slide rules is, you could say, 1/3 of 1 or 1 divided by 3 was 0.3. You could say it was 0.33 or 0.33333. To infinity, right? All of them, actually, the most accurate is, I guess, the one to the infinity. Even then, it's not perfectly accurate. It's 1/3. But expressed as a decimal, you have to express it with lots of threes. And people were tempted to say, it's 0.333333. But you couldn't be accurate to that fourth or fifth place. And a slide rule really would make that clear. Well, it's about 0.3, give or take. Slide rule made it very clear. You can only be so accurate. And I wish we'd remember this, because it turns out computers have the same problem. They can only be so accurate. With integers, whole numbers, they can be perfectly accurate. But as soon as you get to decimal arithmetic. In a computer world, they call it floating point arithmetic because the point can move around. It's floating. Just like the name, the value's floating too. And in fact, there was an Intel chip that couldn't do floating point math accurately because it couldn't. It was a bug. It would get the wrong answer. So I wish, but this is a lesson we didn't learn. And you see this all the time in the news and stuff where people say, 78.643% of all Americans. And it's not, you don't have that kind of accuracy. So the slide rule was kind of good for something. Something we now think because we have a calculator that says 0.333333, that must be right. That's the most accurate representation. Yeah, there was maybe that's a lesson we could bring back. So I'm bringing back slide rules. I got one of them. I guess it's really only about 5 foot, maybe 4.5 feet long, wooden yellow picket slide rule. It's even less accurate. But I've kind of have a feeling of hanging it up in the studio, like Mr. DeVore, my chemistry professor, his teacher in high school. 8888 Ask Leo. We can talk about that. Can't talk to me on Facebook anymore. I finally had it. Have you had it with Facebook? I've had it with Facebook. You know, Mark Zuckerberg got on, on TV, made all sorts of pseudo apologies. We're going to try harder, do better. But nobody's really acknowledging the fundamental truth of the matter here. Facebook's entire business, Google too, by the way, Facebook's entire business is predicated on getting as much information about you as it can and then using that information, selling that information, giving it to other people for advertising purposes. That's their whole business model. So when Mark Zuckerberg says, we're going to do better, we're going to audit these guys, we're going to hold on to your information, there's a company that was designed from day one to hoover up as much information about you as it could and sell it to the highest bidder, period. End of sentence, period. And I think we're seeing the consequences of this because now we know that, Russians used it to try to influence, disrupt in our country. I'm not talking about any, political candidate in general. I'm talking about the idea that the Russians love it if we're all fighting with one another. So they made sure they had really, horrific ads on both sides of every issue and groups, Facebook groups, and they could do it from your likes. Later in the show, I'll tell you, this is all based on research from about 6 years ago on what likes tell you. And it turns out, and by the way, likes are still freely available on Facebook. You can find out what a person's likes are on Facebook easily enough for whatever purposes you want. If I have about 65 of your likes, I can predict your race, your gender, your sexual orientation with very high accuracy. Just 65 likes. Give me 500 likes. I know more about you than your spouse does. And this is not a flaw or a bug, as Facebook would like to pretend. This is their business model. So I realized, I'm just, it's not that I want to be more private because I'm not a private person, obviously. So more about me probably than a lot of my family does, but because I talk about it on the air. But I don't want to reward them. I don't like that business model. I don't want to reward them. More problematic, Google. We can talk about that. 8888 Ask Leo. Kim Schaffer's here. She's answering the phones. Let's get some people online. Let's talk about tech. First, though, I'd like to talk about a company I am a big fan of and have been for years, partly because, they've been sponsoring this show for more than a decade. Carbonite. Carbonite. Carbonite is the data protection leader for business. And, of course, that can mean a lot of things. It means high availability off-site backup. So if disaster strikes, you're ready. If you get four nor'easters in a row and your servers go down, you're ready. You're back to business in seconds. RTOs, real RTOs measured in minutes with push-button cloud failover. Carbonite Recover, that's one of the tools you want to look at. Disaster recovery as a service. Love this idea. Your data is always current because it's constantly synchronized, so recovery points are never more than a few seconds old. In business, that's important. Downtime means lost revenue, period. You want to minimize it. IT guys will love it, especially in complex IT environments. You've got Carbonite Recover as orchestration, automation, of course, expert professional services and support every stage of the way from deployment to testing to fail over and fail back 24/7, 365 days a year. And of course, with Carbonite Recover, your data is always fully encrypted. Learn more about Carbonite Recover and the Carbonite Data Protection Platform. It's disaster recovery as a service at Carbonite, C-A-R-B-O-N-I-T-E, Carbonite.com. We'll take a little teeny-weeny break to hear from our fine sponsors who know nothing about you, and yet they've felt that they should advertise here because you're good people. They know that much. We'll be back right after this. Hey ho, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo.
Hey, oh, let's go.
It's not how you spell, but that's okay. Hey, it's Kim Schaffer. Lo and behold, answering the phones. Hello, Kim.
Good morning. I'm back.
You're a little hoarse.
Yeah, it's been a long week of.
You sound sultry.
Sultry.
It's the sultry. Kim Schaffer. Hi, sultry. So, Kim, when you call, Kim will answer the phone. Hello.
Hello. I have a question.
That should get some calls. Hello. We'll prepare you for your appearance on national radio.
Absolutely.
You calm people down, right? You say, take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. No one listens to this show anyway, right?
Very rarely do I get a caller that's super nervous.
No,
once in a while,
yeah.
It's like, I don't want to go on the air. Can I ask the question off the air? No, you can't. It's a radio show. There's a reason you're calling.
Yeah. Well, think of it this way. When you call the radio show, you're my partner in crime. You're
exactly.
Helping me make an entertaining couple of hours. For the people out there, the people. We're doing it for the people.
As we've said before, if you didn't call, it would be just Leo talking.
And you've already had a taste of that, and you don't need any more. So who should I start with here?
How about Glenn in Malibu? He's got a ton of photos on his iPhone. A lot of them are duplicates, and Apple's telling him the only way to get rid of them is to delete them one by one.
Solution.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Thank you, Kim. Hello, Glenn. How's the weather in Malibu? Yeah.
Spectacular, Leo. 75 degrees somewhere.
Shut up. Just shut up. So you have to, you know, this is really common. And I think Apple might have some incentive in saying, oh, yeah, you need a new phone. This is what you need, dude. You need buy a new iPhone. But you don't have to do that.
I did it. I went out and bought the 10. And I've literally got 67,000 photos.
Wow.
30,000 are duplicates.
You shouldn't carry those around on your phone. That's for sure. First of all, if you lose your phone, you lose the photos. I presume that you are already backing them up somewhere. I hope you are.
I am. I back up to the iCloud.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things you can do. If you go into your photos settings on the iPhone, you can turn on the iCloud photo library. And it even says there may be a checkbox. I think there is. There's a series of checkboxes that then light up once you say, okay, I want to use iCloud. Then one of them is, keep lower quality copies of your photos on your phone to save space. Optimize phone storage is the checkbox. If your phone is low on space, full resolution photos and videos are automatically replaced with optimized versions. That should make some room. And the nice thing is the full-size photos are still stored on iCloud. But here's the thing. Apple likes you to do this because iCloud's not free, is it? With that many photos, you're going to have to buy 200 gigabytes or more of iCloud storage.
Yeah, I think I bought a terabyte.
Yeah, that's expensive. So let me tell you another way you could do it, or maybe we'd make this the secondary way, which will also get these photos off the phone entirely, and that is Google Photos. It's a free. You got it? Okay, that's a free service. Google Photos is much like iCloud. It's a secondary way to back up. There is a setting. I love this setting, by the way, in your Google Photos. If you go into the settings where it says, hey, would you like to delete all your backed up photos? It's under Manage Device Storage.
Okay.
Remove original photos and videos from your device that are already backed up. There's even a button that says free up space. And so that means before you can free up any space, you're going to have Google Photos on your iPhone. And Apple's funny with non-Apple programs, they don't let them run in the background for very long. So what I do is I open Google Photos and I put my iPhone on the charger and I leave it open overnight. Might even take longer than that with 60,000 photos. And just let it back up till they're all backed up. There'll be a little puffy cloud with a check mark in it once they're all backed up.
Do I need to do something to keep my phone from shutting off?
Or... Well, that's why I put it on the charger. That may have to do with your power settings. You could say leave phone on if it's on the charger. Because otherwise it backs up just as long as it can stay in background, which is only 15 minutes, which means you're going to back up, you know, a few hundred photos at a time. So the trick is to get them all backed up and then press that free up space button. The reason you can do this, I mean, one of the reasons you keep all those photos on your phone is so you can show people.
Right.
Because they go, hey, let me show you the grandkids or whatever, and you got it on the phone. That's why Apple's choice is to keep all the photos there, but in thumbnail version, just suitable for showing on the phone. That takes less space, but doesn't get rid of them all. Google's solution deletes them all and is fine as long as you're online. Because you can then open Google Photos or even the Apple Photos, and you can get the downloaded thumbnail of the picture, which is probably fine.
So for the duplicates, the best way to eliminate the duplicates is to use the Google technology.
Nobody wants to delete duplicates because it's hard to tell if a photo is a duplicate. That's the real challenge of it. You can't do it by looking at the photo. You can't do it by looking at the photo. There might be slight differences you miss. It's like that.
I'd be happy to miss 20,000.
I know. So you could do, you have to do it manually. There are programs you can run, but again, this is somewhat risky. First of all, Google's storage is unlimited and free. So that might reassure you a little bit about having duplicates. At least you're not paying to store them. And then what I do is I have duplicates too. And in fact, Google Photos kind of helps me get duplicates because I have it backing up from several locations. And so I often get duplicates. Periodically, I'll go through it. You can have Google Photos sort your photos. So it's very smart about this. Once it's had the photos for a few weeks, it'll have categorized them by all sorts of ways. You know, all your dog pictures, all your pictures of your nephew Joe, all of that stuff.
Sure.
And then you can either use a chronological search to delete duplicates. My problem is a lot of my duplicates are not chronological because I edited them in Lightroom and then they got re-uploaded at a different date. So you can do it by topic. You can say, well, show me all my pictures of Paris and then clean them up, that kind of thing. So you can use Google's smarts to help you with that a little bit. But you got to do it manually, I'm sorry to say. The nice thing is once it's on Google, it's on your you can use go to photos.google.com on your computer and you can use your mouse to select vast swaths of photos and delete them en masse, which I find very satisfying.
Yeah, I'm noticing that the Apple support. Apple seems to be going the way of Sears and Kmart and GM. They seem to be so big.
I know.
They're playing the IBM ROM.
They used to be great, and it's really sad. That's the way of all things. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The magic music means it's time for the magic man, Mr. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater geek.
That's me.
AVSforum.com. Each week he joins us and talks about getting better sound and vision in your man cave or your woman cave.
That's right.
Hello,
she
Scott.
She shed, I've heard it said.
Your she shed? That doesn't sound like a good place to be. I don't want to go to my she shed. Let's see. We've talked about movies. We've talked about HDR TVs, 4K. We've talked about Atmos sound. I told you last week, you were right, because I saw Black Panther in an Atmos theater. It sounded so good.
Yeah.
Loved the sound. Now, you've actually converted me and convinced me that I should probably look at getting Atmos at home with a upward firing speaker. So I'm all excited about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I just saw a story. We had talked about micro LED after the CES show.
Right. That was one of the big stories.
The new screen technology. Samsung showed it at the show, but they're having trouble getting the pixels down small enough. What I didn't know is that Apple bought a micro LED company a few years ago And the rumor is strong that Apple is working on its own displays using micro LED. Initially, for the Apple Watch.
Yeah, that's what I heard, for the watch. And I'm going, what? Wait a second. That's a tiny little screen.
Yeah. I mean, they'd have to get the pixels down.
What does it really need micro LED for? Get the pixels way down.
And maybe battery life. Is that possible?
That could be another problem. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And then, of course, but this is also how Apple works, because they like to do it on a smaller volume thing. And then if it works well, look at the iPhone. Because if you're going to make something work on the iPhone, you have to be able to make 100 million of them a year.
Yeah.
You know, you have to really get good at it.
And I got to tell you, the manufacturing process for micro LED is not trivial.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to pick it's a process that one way to do it is called pick and place. So you actually pick up these tiny little wafers and move them around. And it has to be so precise, the placement of them, I can't imagine doing it on a watch. I mean, the distance between the individual little pixels nowadays, I think the benchmark is something like on the order of just under a millimeter. And that's fine on a TV size screen that you're going to sit 10 feet away from. But on a watch,
Scott,
or even a phone?
Scott, this is Apple you're talking about. They love challenges.
That's true.
And this is a big deal because they haven't made their own screens in forever.
I mean, yeah, that's true.
In fact, I don't know if they ever made their own screens. They always use screens from LG and other companies. Samsung makes the screen for the iPhone X.
Yeah.
So this would be a big deal if Apple, solved the problem. And, of course, they can throw a lot of money at it. Their research and development budget has gone up.
That's true.
And then maybe it'll come to the watch, and who knows, maybe even to Macintoshes.
But how much would a watch be that had a very expensive manufacturing process?
Well, I mean, they obviously have to solve it first. They bought this company, it was called, I think, MicroView in 2014. So they've had this technology.
Well, they've been working on it for a while. Yeah.
Oh, they have a 30,000 square foot factory building these in Santa Clara. So this is not a small, Apple does nothing small.
Does nothing small. No, I admit that. I agree with that. And hey, if anybody can do it, it's them, I would say. Yeah. So more power to them. I would love to see them get the dot pitch, as it's called, the distance between the pixels, down to a tenth of a millimeter or something. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. And I bet you that's what they're saying too. In fact, those were the exact words Tim Cook. That'd be awesome.
And so it would. Yeah.
So, But actually, I understated the size of the factory. 62,000 square feet.
Holy moly. Wow.
That's a big factory in Santa Clara.
That's a big factory.
And there are 300 engineers there. They're working on it.
And specifically for micro LED?
Well, that's what Bloomberg says. And Mark Gurman, who's the Bloomberg Apple guy, is the king of Apple rumors. So, it's kind of hard to hide a 62,000 square foot factory.
Yes.
My guess is that's accurate.
Well, I'm not as interested in watches and phones as I am in large screen displays.
Right.
And if Apple can improve the technology to the point where it looks good on a watch or a phone, it's going to look amazing on a big screen TV. Whether or not Apple will actually make a big screen TV with micro LED, I don't know. We've heard rumors for years about an Apple OLED TV or, an Apple this or that.
What they were waiting for. I don't know.
Maybe.
They have a separate factory for the... What did you call that? Where they place the LEDs on there, transfer?
Pick and place.
The pick and place. They have a separate pick and place. And then they also have a factory in Taiwan they just opened, Display Research Lab. So this sounds like something they're all in on.
It sounds like it to me, too.
Yeah.
Of course, they've got more money than God. So
yeah, they can afford it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I wouldn't, of course, Apple's going to keep it to themselves as much as they can. That could be secret sauce when it comes to the iPhone. They need something that makes them better than the other guys. But on the other hand, I could see them licensing the technology for television manufacturers, right?
Wouldn't that be awesome? That would be
amazing.
And
the truth is, how this works. People do research, fundamental research, in making this work better. Even if they keep it to themselves, kind of, it burbles out into the environment.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Somebody is saying 62,000 square feet is tiny for a manufacturing facility. Well, they're not making them in bulk yet.
Yeah, right.
Sounds
this is an R&D.
Right. They're making a few at a time, see if it works.
See what works. They're experimenting.
Somebody saw the displays for the watch. They were hooked up to a big old computer with lots of wires coming out. The watch is a lower resolution thing. It's a smaller display, too, though. I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. It doesn't need to be super high res. I think the iPhone or, a phone needs to be kind of higher res.
Yes. I can't remember what the dots per inch. That's what the dots per inch is what matters. And I can't
is what matters.
Yeah,
correct.
I can't remember what the DPI for the phone is versus the.
Right. I just heard something recently about somebody achieving a breakthrough in DPI, getting like twice as dense. This is DPI is really pixel density, right?
Yeah.
It's how many pixels per inch, or you could also
express
it as per square inch.
The Apple Watch displays 326 DPI. That's pretty high.
Yeah. I think I heard a breakthrough of something like 1400 or 1500. DPI.
See, we've got 607, you know, DPI, almost 600 DPI in a lot of phones. That seems to me overkill because you can't, even if you hold your nose next to it, the whole point of dots per inch is getting enough so that you can't see a dot.
Right.
But it's after that point, well, that's,
it becomes pointless. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. This is the whole argument about 4K that we used to have. You know, is look at normal TV sizes, at normal seating distances, you can't see the resolution
right.
of 4K.
iPhone so is 458 dots per inch. So
okay.
it's higher resolution. And I think the Samsung Galaxy S9 Plus is pushing 500,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure. So, you know, I think we're as good. Actually, you know where they want to get this higher and where it might make sense for Apple to be working on this? Virtual reality and
Precisely.
Augmented reality.
And in fact, now you're reminding me, that's what this announcement was for a virtual reality headset at that super high.
Because your eyes are inches from the screen. So
that makes sense to me. Tons.
High DPI.
Yep.
Interesting.
I would definitely buy into VR at that kind of pixel density.
That might be really what Apple's up to. We figured it out. You and I, between us, Scott Wilkinson, he writes at avsforum.com. He's the editor over there, and he joins us each week to talk home theater. I'm sorry, I derailed your entire segment, Scott.
Totally fine.
We'll see you next week.
You bet.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll go back to the phones right after this. As our FM radio. This was FM radio is kind of a freebie from the point of view of the manufacturers. They get it with the Qualcomm chipset in most cases. But many manufacturers don't turn it on, or even in the case of Apple, don't, because they disable the silicon. And I think they do it because the phone carriers don't like it. They say, you can listen to free radio and do exactly what you do, save data. We don't like that.
Right.
We want you to use data so we can charge you for it. So it's my guess that's why in the U.S., in fact, the National Association of Broadcasters has a big push to get FM radios back into phones. I mean, their excuse is it's for safety, and that's for sure. If the cell towers are down and the power is out and nothing's working, at least you can get a radio station on your phone. That's pretty cool. But I don't know. You know, obviously the NAB represents radio stations, so they like it. I don't see any movement towards putting radios back in phones in the U.S.
What about the AM chip? I mean, I would love to just tune into AM 640.
And I would too. And you know, KFI would like it, but an AM antenna is a little bit more complicated of a device. The FM antenna, most of these phones use your headphones as the antenna, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because that's FM will work with a wire. AM is at such a low frequency. Let's see, it's in megahertz. Let's see, FM's in megahertz, AM's in kilohertz. So it's a lot lower. So you need a lot longer wire. So AM radios, if you look inside, they have a coil for the antenna. And I think that's my guess, and I'm sure some ham will call me or radio engineer will call me and explain this. But my guess is the reason you don't see AM radios in phones is because it's hard to get good reception. You can't put a coil radio inside a phone, coil antenna, obviously, inside of a phone. So, you know, the phone, the carriers want you to use, and I don't know if Google's this way or not, but Google and AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile and they'd all like you to use iHeartRadio to listen. And that way you use data, everybody wins.
Yeah, and that's just one of those things where I don't want to be strapped down to using iHeart for everything. And then
I understand. It's great to have a radio in your phone. The other problem with AM is it's a little more – I don't have an AM radio in my Tesla either. And Tesla says it's because it's more susceptible to the noise from the electric motors. And maybe there's enough noise inside a phone that an AM radio would sound bad. So it could be one of those two things.
Yeah, there wasn't much on the internet as to why there wasn't an AM receiver in phones, but you explained it.
Well, I'm guessing. And you're going to see fewer and fewer phones with FM. Remember President Trump said he wanted Apple to put radios back in their phones, and Apple said, he said, why do they turn off the radio on their phones? And Apple said, we never turned them off. They never were there. Apple designs its own silicon and I guess doesn't need to put it in there. So, oh, well. Oh, well.
Yeah. All right, sir. Well,
My pleasure. I'm a radio fan. I like it. The good news is you can go out, of course, and buy C-Crane and others sell little portables, tiny little portable radios the size of an iPod you could carry around with you. It's interesting, though. I don't have a AM radio in my car. They phased out the cassette player a long time ago. There's no CD player either. Really, the way Tesla's, and I suspect this is true of other electric vehicles are designed, is that stream. They want you to stream. Get your audio via Bluetooth on your phone or... You know, many cars now have LTE or 3G built into the car and get it that way. That's what they want you to do. And then everybody wins except us. Everybody wins except the consumer. You know, we got to make a living. Got to make money. Companies got to get rich. Oh, well. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. I think there are some electric vehicles with AM radios. I think so. I think it's completely possible to shield it. I know those motors do create a lot of noise, but there you go. We'll be back with more calls in just a second. Let me see who's on the line here. Our next caller will be Chip in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He's trying to get auditions for free. He wants to know if he can get work without an agent using the internet. Ah, we can talk about that. That's an interesting question. But first, a word from our sponsor, Simply Safe. Simply Safe, love it. The number one the fastest growing anyway, home security company in the nation. 2 million customers, and I think they're growing even faster because the new Simply Safe is awesome. It's prepared for anything you could throw at it. Bad guys say, well, let's cut the phone line. Simply Safe still works. If a storm takes out your power, Simply Safe still works. Let's say the bad guys get in, they destroy the keypad. Arr! Or a siren, they hit it with a bat. Simply Safe will still get you the help you need. Okay, maybe it's overkill. Maybe you don't need to be ready for every worst-case scenario, but that's what makes Simply Safe's home security systems so great. It's always ready. Now, the nice thing about Simply Safe, it doesn't cost an arm and a leg. They only charge you what's fair. Little, adorable little sensors. They're practically invisible. You can put them in yourself. So that saves you money on an installer. You only pay $14.99 a month for 24-hour professional security monitoring with no contracts, no hidden fees. I love this. That's why I tell everybody about Simply Safe. I'm telling you right now, right? Go to simplysafeleo.com today. Protect your home and family with Simply Safe. SimplySafeLeo.com. Put together all the sensors you need, the motion, glass break, doors and window opening. Put it all in yourself. You'll save 24-hour monitoring. Simply Safe. It's really great. SimplySafeLeo.com. Chip in Cherry Hill. What kind of work are you looking for, Chip?
I'm just trying to get my foot in the door.
As an actor or voiceover or?
Anything. But the thing that's stopping me right now is I go to L.A. Casting right away at $14 a month.
Yeah.
I think $90 to start off with.
There are voiceover sites. I don't know how well they work. You know, acting, you know, I don't know how the internet could help you. You certainly you probably want to look at what – actually, you know, we're on in Hollywood on KFI. Maybe some actors will call and tell us. Do you still need an agent to get the auditions to go around, or can you just create a great website? My guess is you do need an agent, but I don't know. Certainly, you got to have a website, right? Facebook page. I have heard that you get better contracts if you have more Twitter followers, because the studios think, well, this guy can promote himself on his Twitter feed. So you definitely want to build that social presence and build those pages. And this is a good case to have a Facebook page, a Twitter account, website. Now, there are, and I don't know how well they work, there are online sites for voiceover. One that comes to mind is Voice Bunny, mostly because it's got a great name. And the idea of Voice Bunny is they've got voice actors. Now, you're competing with thousands of others. Actually, they say 28,000. But the idea is you put your sample up there, and then people who are looking for voiceover will go there instead of the much more complex process of getting a talent agency and trying people out and all that stuff. I think that this is a growth area. Voice actors are needed, too, for games. They're needed for, you know, documentaries, filmmaking. There's a lot more of that going on. Advertisements for podcasts, that kind of thing. So Voice Bunny is one of several, but this is a place where professional voice actors can go and try to get work. So that would be a good start. At least it'll help you to be a little resume builder. 8888-ASK-LEO. If you're a professional working in Hollywood, I know many of you listen. Because as an actor, you have a lot of free time. if you do, what do you suggest? Do you have to get an agent? Do you need a manager? 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Our website, techguylabs.com. You can put a comment up there, too. It's free. No sign up. We'd love to hear what you think. TechGuyLabs.com. More of your calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. We're talking smartphones. We're talking smart watches. Anything with a chip in it. I'd love to talk about it. your Internet of Things devices in your home, your how many? I'm just curious. It's hard to count them up. I don't really count them, but fortunately, I have a Wi-Fi device that tells me. Maybe yours does. How many connected devices there are in my home? And I would guess, because I'm an early adopter and you know, kind of a geek, that I probably have I'm on the high side for internet connected internet devices. I've got 41 currently, all at once connected on my on my Wi-Fi router. How many do you have? 41. That's I guess that's a high number. You know, I'm just thinking. Of course, there's laptops, there's desktops, and I've got a few laptops. There's phones. I got more than one phone. And then everybody in the family. I've got a teenager, so you know he's got a phone and an iPad and a computer. All the TVs are hooked up, and each TV has more than one internet connection because, you know, it's got the Chromecast and the Roku and the Apple TV. And now, and I'm not normal in that respect. You don't need more than one of those, but I have to look at all of them. And then I have multiple of those. And then then there's the Internet of Things devices. And that's where the number really starts to skyrocket. The Sonos speakers, the Echo devices, the Google Home devices, the oven. Yeah, I've got an oven connected to the internet. The sous vide device. Yeah, I've got two connected to the internet. It just goes on and on and on. And the really scary thing about all this is everything connected to the internet potentially is a access point, a highway for bad guys to get into your house and to hack your stuff or try to find your Bitcoin wallet or whatever it is they do these days, or maybe just mess with you. So each one of them has to be kept up to date. Rule number one, if you're going to buy a device that you're going to take home that's going to connect to the internet, I think I can safely now start making rules for these. We've had rules for what you should do with your computer to keep it safe. That's that update rule that I've mentioned before. It comes from a book called Future Crimes. And I think it's a pretty good kind of acronym for what you should do. Maybe some overkill, but a good thing to keep in mind to keep yourself safe. You can read the update acronyms at Future Crimes, the book. It's Mark Goodman's book about hackers and so forth. But his update algorithm is pretty simple to remember. In fact, the word itself is kind of the beginning of it all. Update. Keep your stuff updated. That's true for computers. And then, you know, good passwords. Be careful what you download. Don't run as administrator. He says turn off your computer. That's the D in update. I don't say that all the time. And then encrypt whenever possible. There's a few things I'd add, you know, two-factor authentication, things like that. But when it comes to Internet of Things devices, we'll have to come up with a new acronym. I'll have to start to work on that. But the number one thing to look for, if you're going to buy a router, an oven, a refrigerator, a doorbell, a camera, yeah, I have a few of those too, and doorbell, is that they are updatable, and more importantly, I think, updatable over the air automatically. Gone are the days on our computers or our smartphones when we, you know, can be expected to check for an update. Oh, it's not updated because you didn't do it. No. Microsoft, Apple, Android, all automatically update. And that's the way it should be because, you know, people forget. More importantly, I think, if there is a big problem that one of these companies learns about, they can push out an update right away. They don't have to wait for you to check in. They just say, fix this fast. We need that for your Internet of Things devices, too. So if you've got Internet of Things devices, well, going forward, let's put it this way. As you buy them, number one, the one first question asked, will this update over the air automatically? Very important. And it's true of good new Internet of Things devices. It's becoming more and more true of routers, for instance. It used to be a router would never get updated. We've learned our lesson with that. The big internet attack that happened last year on DYN, on Dyn, the DNS server, happened because some college kids figured out This is the Mirai botnet. They figured out how to get in. That a number of routers weren't very secure. They had hardwired passwords, things like that. And they'd never been updated because people don't update stuff. And so they were able to take over thousands of home routers and use them to attack the internet. So from now on, your next router anyway should be automatically updated. And you want a company that's going to stand behind it for some years and keep it up to date and fix flaws. And don't buy a internet-connected doorbell or locks. Really true for locks, right? You don't want a flaw in your home, in your lock. Really true for your ovens, and less of a problem on your oven, right? What if somebody hacks my oven? It's not really, I should say, though, that it's just hacking your oven that's the problem. If they can get into the oven, if the oven doesn't have good security on its internet connection, that becomes a gateway into your house and the rest of your devices, right? Once somebody's on your network, they have lots more things they can do. So it's not just securing your oven. You turned my oven all the way up. You burnt my chicken. No hackers trying to burn my chicken, I would presume. But actually, my oven has a camera in it, so maybe they're trying to see what I'm cooking. I don't know. But it's the bigger issue of them using the device, whatever that is, to get into your system. So that's going to be number one on our list. We'll think more about what we should do with Internet of Things devices. But automatic, over-the-air firmware upgrades, number one. Number one. Change the password if there's a password to get online. You know, in your router, you should change the password. And if you don't need access to that device from the outside world, some things you do, some things you don't. I want to be able to access my video doorbell from the outside world, right? Because I want to see if there's somebody at my door. But I don't need to get my router settings when I'm at work. So turn off that WAN administration. That's what they call it in most routers. The Wide Area Network Administration. The ability to administer your router from the outside world. Well, turn that off. You don't need that. And that just gives a bad guy one more way they can mess with you, right? So we'll think of a few other things. Change the default password. That's a big one. Put that on the list. I got to make a clever acronym like Mark did. Maybe you've got some suggestions. Locking down your Internet of Things devices. We're learning more about the Uber pedestrian crash of last week. At first, you know, I had to say you have to blame the pedestrian. Now I'm not so sure. It looks like, in fact, Uber had played it fast and loose, what a surprise, with their autonomous vehicles, and they weren't, in fact, as smart as they should be. And that dash cam video should have picked up that pedestrian. That Uber should have at least slowed down and probably should have stopped. It was not her fault. Well, I mean, you could, of course, you shouldn't be crossing the road at night in the dark where there's no crosswalk, of course. But this is where self-driving cars should do better. That LiDAR, those cameras can see in the dark. They should have seen her, and they didn't. So people like Brad Templeton, who I highly respect, who's an autonomous car critic, but also supporter. I've talked to Brad for years about the future. Self-driving vehicles are smarter and better and should cause fewer accidents than humans do. But this one, mm-mm. And it looks like the blame has to be placed at the feet of Uber for not doing as good a job with their vision system. I'll put a link in the show notes to Brad's website, ideas.4brad.com, because he has a pretty good article about this and changed my mind, frankly. We'll have more of your calls coming up in just a little bit. I want to talk about something I did the other day, maybe 5 years ago, that I love. And then I did something the other day as a result. What I did 5 years ago, I got my genetic analysis done by 23andMe. Now, you might say, oh, that must have cost a pretty penny. No. In fact, the reason I did it was really it was the first widely available consumer affordable DNA analytics. And they get better every year. And the nice thing is I did it years ago, but every year I get more reports from 23andMe. And now these enhanced ancestry reports, they're great. What if you could go back 60,000 years and kind of explore your ancestors? What might you discover? What amazing things could you uncover that illuminates who you are? Those 23 pairs of chromosomes you inherited from your parents, and they inherited from theirs, and they inherited from theirs, and back all the way. Those say a lot about you. And you go to 23andMe, you can find out more than ever before with their enhanced ancestry service. Trace your family history from 150-plus regions. They have a new interactive map, the ethnicity wheel. You can discover where around the world your ancestors may have lived. Not just in the last 200 years, but you can go back 60,000 years and discover the ancient migration paths of your ancestors. And with more than 5 million people in the Family Connections database, you can opt in and connect with DNA family members worldwide. Look, we all have a DNA story. It's so cool. And I did this years ago, but I've recently got it. It was a Christmas present for my mom and my sister, and we're getting it for Dad. My wife's done it. It's just awesome. Order your kit at the number 23andme.com/Leo. That's 23andme.com/Leo. Find out about your roots. It's so fascinating. 23andme.com/Leo. More of the Tech Guy Show still to come. Website, techguylabs.com. Don't forget to visit there. It's free. It's open 24/7, 7 days a week. You can search it. And if you've got thoughts and suggestions, you can leave comments, too. We'd love to hear those. Leo Laporte, the Dreadlock Rasta Tech Guy at 8888-ASK-LEO. Bonnie Costa Mesa is next. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Hey.
My phone battery's still.
I'm sorry to keep you on hold so long. If Leo would just stop talking, everything would be fine. I'm sorry.
I hope it doesn't cut out while I get my answer.
Okay.
Anyway, about a little over a year ago, I finally went kicking and screaming and bought a new computer, Win 10 computer. I was very proficient with XP, and I did not want to give it up. Anyway, I had a Western Digital external hard drive that I was using with that. And when I plugged it into my new computer, it says it's empty. And I know it's not. I know all my files are backed up in there.
Do you still have the old computer? Can you check it on the old computer? Do you see it on the old computer?
Do I see it there?
Yeah. Can you see? In other words, the drive doesn't work on the new computer, but if you plug it into the old computer, can you see it?
Well, I can see it. Yeah, I can.
Well,
see
I mean,
it
can you see the data?
It just says that, you know, it doesn't say there's no files in there.
Can you see the data on the old computer?
The data? Is that what you said? The data or the date?
The data.
Well, I don't have it on, and I.
Okay, so that's the first thing to do is just check. Let's see. Can we? You know, I mean, if there's something, it shouldn't be anything in Windows 10 that makes it not able to see a hard drive you can see on an XP machine. But if that's the case, you would find that out by plugging the, I presume it's an external hard drive, a USB hard drive. Just take it out, plug it into the old machine. You still have it, plug it in. Can I see the data then? Well, okay, maybe there is something in Windows 10 that's not working. Or maybe the cable's bad, or maybe the port's bad, or something else is going on. But I have to say, what's most likely is that there wasn't anything on that hard drive when you thought there was, even on XP. If it doesn't seem to be anything on the hard drive now, then I think it's probably likely there wasn't then. But I can't tell until you plug it into the old machine. So first step, plug it into the old machine. Is your data okay? Is it there? If it is, hey, good news. You've got the data on the old machine too, right? Back it up to the external hard drive and try again. It's always a good idea when you get a new system, keep the old system or at least the old hard drive around for a while. Make sure all the data got moved over to the new system just fine. There's a lot that other things that could have gone wrong. I mean, make sure you're, I don't know, maybe you're using a backup program. I don't know how you got the data on the external drive. The first thing we got to do is go back and look and see if you can see it on the old computer. Sometimes there are external drives. Somebody's pointing out in the chat room, this is true. I doubt you have this kind, but Samsung makes one called the T3, for instance. It's a little external USB drive. It has a special software on it that makes it invisible unless it's been installed. It's encrypted. So if there is specialized software you needed to access that drive on the XP machine, you'll need to install it on the Windows 10 machine. But the bottom line on this is Windows 10 should be able to see anything Windows XP can see. No problem. I don't think there's anything Windows 10 is doing. It's using the new NTFS file system. But guess what? It's not that new. XP used it as well. So the file system's the same. I'm looking. Maybe it's hidden. It really depends on how you got those files on there. If you drag the files on the X-Bay machine, if you dragged them from one folder on the internal hard drive to a folder on the external hard drive, all should be well. However, if you use some specialized software or to back it up, or maybe there's encryption on it, there's things you can do that would make it invisible. Main thing to do at this point is assume that there's data on there that you want to keep. And check on another computer to see if you can see it, particularly the computer you made it with. And yeah, this is really a good lesson for all of us. When you move to a new computer, make sure you got a good copy of your data. And just in case, don't get rid of the old data, the old computer, the old hard drive until you verify you've got a full copy on the new one. More commonly, what you get is it looks like I got everything and I didn't. That's much more common. 8888, ask Leo the phone number. Back to line one, Jim. Tallahassee, Florida. Hi, Jim. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
I ain't going to embarrass either one of us by telling the world how long I've been listening to you. So we will just stop there.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't really want to say you're wrong, but...
Oh, I can be wrong. Caller, that's okay.
The caller earlier who was worrying about his duplicate photos...
Yeah.
I've actually found an application that works pretty well... Because I had one of those older ones, you used to have to look at the little thumbnail and then compare the thumbnails visually to figure out, if these were the same photos or not. And that got real old real quick.
Yeah, no kidding. So what do you recommend?
Well, there's a program called Easy Duplicate Finder.
Yeah.
Now, it allows you to set up, you can go anything from a name to a CRC checksum, and it works on Windows from XP to 10. And then, since I don't speak Mac, there's like, half a dozen Mac, it works on the Mac also. But like I said, I have been renewing my subscription to this program for quite a while. And I am very, very, very happy with it.
Excellent. I appreciate the tip. See, I said that you would help. I knew Jim would call. I knew. I was just waiting for you. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, like I said, it's not that expensive a program.
Sounds like a good idea.
I have been using it for quite a while, and I keep renewing it because it keeps working.
EasyDuplicateFinder.com. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's tough with photos only because you can have a photo that's essentially a duplicate, but that you maybe modified slightly. It will look like a duplicate to you, but it won't look the same to something like this because it isn't the same. And that's why photos are a particularly big challenge. But hey, if it works, do it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless, but not for long. The future.
Sports of the Tech Guy Show brought to you by the amazing Epson EcoTank printers, cartridge reprinting, and years of ink in the box. Find out more at Epson.com/EcoTank. Epson, exceed your vision. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Jeremy, Moore Park, California. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Leo. How you doing, man?
I'm great. Thanks for hanging on.
Yeah, no problem. I always love listening to you, man. You always think you have a lot of knowledge.
Thank you.
A lot of different questions have been answered by you. See if you can crack this quick one. I'm sure this is child's play for you, but
I'm always worried when I hear that. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm dead serious, man. I don't know if you have any knowledge about the Microsoft Creators updates.
Yes.
Okay, right now I'm currently running build 17115.1R S4.
Okay.
And it's an education build. I have another computer here, which is a home build that I put on. They're both 1803. I'm just giving you the build number.
Yeah.
1803.
1803 is the so you're on the insider's builds.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So that's problem number one, which is you've agreed to be a beta tester.
That's right.
Guess what happens to beta testers?
You've
been getting a lot of builds lately because we're getting close to 1803, which is the update, which has no name at this point except 1803, that Microsoft's going to push out in April. Big update, big spring update for Windows 10. But you probably over the last few weeks have gotten three or four new updates as they get closer to that.
Yeah, exactly. I've had about three of them total.
Yeah.
And
so what's the issue?
Well, one computer I'm running 17128.1,
mm-hmm.
and then one, and that's a home build, and the other is a 17115.1 RS4.
Yeah.
Now I have a Lenovo.
RS4 is Redstone 4. That's the next version, believe it or not.
Which one is?
That's the next version of Windows. It's not the 1803 update. You're already starting to receive the next Windows Insider updates for the fall 2018 update.
Okay.
Anyway, what's the problem? Before we get in a number stew here, maybe I can help you. What's
all boring?
Yeah. Well, because you're running beta versions and you're running different beta versions, you're going to have differing results, obviously. So.
That's correct. Okay.
You're on the skip ahead.
Right.
No, that's what they call it—the skip ahead. You're skipping ahead to the next one.
Yeah, I am, man. And I decided to do it. I just decided to try it out.
So the code name for the update we're going to get this next month is Redstone 3. That new one you've got 128 is Redstone 4. That's going to be the least reliable build of Windows out there, because that is a beta for something that won't be shipped for 6 more months, if that makes sense.
Okay.
The other one, which is Redstone 3, RS3, that's a beta for something that's going to be shipped in a week or two. That's going to be very close to the final version. So you've got two versions that are the farthest apart they're ever going to be.
Okay. So I have a 17285, and then I have a 17115.
Right.
And RS4.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what would you do? Would you have them both on 17285?
Well, it kind of depends what you're looking for. First of all, I don't run the Insider's builds. As much as I'd like to know what's coming, I want my systems to be fairly stable. So I just let Microsoft handle my Windows updates. You're doing something that Microsoft loves and enthusiasts should absolutely do, which is testing the next version of Windows for Microsoft. And they've had some great success doing this. They call it the Insider's program, because they get literally millions of people trying the new version of Windows before the rest of us. And that's a good thing, because the more people test a version, the more likely you'll find bugs before you get there. Now, you've become even more aggressive when you go to this skip ahead, the next Insider build, because you're not just, as I said, you're not using the version that is soon to be released. You're using the version that is farthest from release that they offer anybody except people inside of Microsoft. So I don't have a suggestion for you, except that, you know, as they explain, although people don't probably read this, when you sign up for this, you've got to think carefully. You know, I would have always one machine, your workhorse machine, sometimes we call it the production machine, that's the one you use day to day. That should not be on any Insider ring at all. You can go into the settings and turn off the Insider ring and go back to being just normal Windows. You can't do it until there's 1803 comes out. When it does come out, turn off the Insider ring on your main machine, your number one machine, and get that just normal. Don't be a beta tester, an early tester. But if you're an enthusiast, you have more than one machine, and a secondary machine, you don't mind if it from time to time fails or doesn't work, then it's fine to do an Insider build on it. You're on Redstone 4 on both of them, which means you're on skip ahead on both of them. You're on different skip aheads, and that you can't control. Microsoft pushes out different versions, so it's not unusual if you have multiple machines on the beta program, on the Windows Insider program. It's not unusual for you to have different builds on it. The Redstone 3, the 1803 builds, should all be fairly close at this point, because we're close to release. You know, Microsoft's not testing a bunch of different stuff. But so I think 2.8 is the – wow, I mean, I don't know. You're a good candidate to listen to my Windows Weekly podcast, a show I do with two real Windows experts. I'm not. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. Paul is on all the different, you know, Insider builds, and he does skip ahead. There are some cool things. One thing in 17.6.2.3 is they've put support for the high-efficiency image file format, HAIF, which is great. Very happy to be seeing that. That's for RS5, though. That's for the skip ahead. So I'm confusing myself. I guess RS4 is 1803. RS5 is a skip ahead. RS stands for Redstone. That's the code name for this version of Windows. I gather that your question is, which one should you be on? I personally think, you know, if you've got machines, I have many Windows machines. I'm not an Insider builds on any of them, because I want the most stable version of Windows. Bad enough when we have a big creators update. I got everything, got to make sure it all works. I don't want to get an update every day or every week. And that's what you get on the Insiders program, especially as you get closer to the final release. But if you're asking me, the skip ahead is for somebody who really has a hankering to know what's next, like this high efficiency image format. Oh, I really want to see that stuff. But when you get skip ahead versions, there's no guarantee that you're going to get something that comes out. Microsoft's testing stuff. They're testing stuff for you. My recommendation is to get off the insiders. If you go to the slow ring, there's several rings. The slow ring will be the most safe if you want to be an insider. Fast ring will be the least safe. And skip ahead, well, who knows what you're going to get. Good luck. My advice to most people is don't be a beta tester. You have to be an enthusiast. And frankly, there's also a higher obligation. I don't know if Microsoft emphasizes this, but if you're a beta tester, your job is to try to break it, find ways that it breaks, and then tell Microsoft, submit forms, appropriate bug reports. That's actually a high duty. You've got to take it seriously. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're dependent on all of you. People who do it. There's people who do it because it's cool, man. I have the latest version of Windows before you do, you know. And those people are less helpful than the people, maybe they're IT professionals who want to test before they, you know, deploy Windows in the office. Or they're just people who care a lot about Windows, like to use it, and want to help Microsoft. That second group is the most important group because those are the people who will take the time to do bug reports, fill it out. And bug reports require a lot of effort because you have to try to recreate the bug, explain exactly how it happened. It's not useful to Microsoft unless you're very thorough in your description of the problem. Otherwise, it's hard for them to find it and fix it. So there's a high responsibility. Unfortunately, I think Microsoft uses this program. They call it the Insider Program. That should tell you something. It's more marketing than it is actual beta testing. Maybe they get a little benefit of the beta testing as a result of doing it, because certainly millions of people are using Windows. It does seem like the last few versions of Windows have been pretty reliable. But on the other hand, not so long ago, we had a version of Windows come out that had horrific problems. They had to fix it real quick. And you had to wonder, well, why didn't the beta testers, if they're testing on millions of people, why didn't the beta testers find it? They released a version of Windows, I think it was about a year ago, that if you plugged a Kindle into it, it crashed. The whole machine crashed. And it disabled many cameras, including, you know, the webcams, including Microsoft's own. And that then, in my mind, it raised a question. Well, I wonder, is this really this insider's program? Is this really qualifying as a pre-release test among, you know, people who are taking the time to report problems? Because if they miss two massive problems like that, how good is this pre-release testing? Surely some of those insiders had Kindles. I know almost all of them had webcams. And nobody bothered to tell Microsoft, or Microsoft didn't get enough information, or what happened? Did they release the version anyway with massive bugs? Now, that hasn't happened since, so maybe they've fixed that problem. But if you're going to be an insider, come please, do us all a favor. Do your job and find bugs and report them effectively to Microsoft so they can squash them, so that the rest of us who are not anxious to try pre-release software on our systems get a reliable operating system. That would be nice. That would be nice. Public betas are all the rage, and I really do think the name tells it all. It's a marketing thing for Microsoft. It takes their most enthusiastic customers and gives them a little something on the inside. And now they're even more enthusiastic. That's really the value of it for Microsoft. It's a shame because massive beta tests are so valuable. I stopped doing the insider bill. It was just crazy. It was too many new versions. Every time you get a new version, by the way, you run the risk of making your machine unusable. And people who are on the insider, getting the latest insider builds, at least once or twice a year are going to get a build that crashes, that destroys your machine. You have to rebuild it. It's not worth it. It really isn't, in my opinion. Unless, and God bless you if you are, you're one of those people who says, no, I want to help the world. I want to help Microsoft make better software. I am going to take this seriously. I'm going to install this stuff, and I'm going to bang on it until I can break it, and then I'm going to report it fully and accurately to Microsoft so they can fix it. If that's you, please, please, be a Windows Insider. Thank you. I thank you, and the community thanks you. You're doing important work. Looky-loos, you... You're not helping. I guess they're not hurting either, right? They're not hurting. So I guess it's all right. If you want to be an insider, fine. Our show today brought to you by some real IT pros, the folks at IT Pro TV. I'm a fan of IT Pro TV. In fact, I know Tim and Don, the founders, from way back. It's a kind of a great story. They were IT trainers, taught people how to get jobs in IT, because it turns out there's such a need for IT professionals. There's millions of unfilled jobs right now in the United States that they've created systems so that people, even if they didn't have work experience, could prove they had the skills so they could fill these jobs. And the way they do it is with tests, certifications, they call them. And if you have the right certs, even if you've never worked in IT, you can get a job in IT. And if you're an IT professional, keeping those certs up to date and getting new ones is part of making you even more desirable. That's where IT Pro TV is so great. It helps people get the certs. That's what Tim and Don did for years. In an engaging, fun way, watching on TV chatting. It's really a great idea. IT Pro TV, they do 125 live hours every week with chat rooms and everything. You can watch on any screen, on your big screen TV, on your iPhone, on your Android device. They have Roku, Apple TV. They have all the apps, Fire TV. Then they also have 3,300 hours of on-demand training. They're building that library all the time in every area of IT, CISM, CISA, SSCP, CEH. No need to go off-site if you're getting IT training for your team. You can stream the courses live and on-demand right there at work or at home. Look, I want you to try it. If you're interested in IT, maybe because you already have a job or because you want to get a job, itpro.tv/Leo. Use the code Leo. You can try it free for 7 days and get 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. itpro.tv/Leo. Don't forget to use my name, Leo, as the offer code for 7 days free. Friendly training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. itpro.tv/Leo. Use my name, Leo. Let's see. Back to the phones. Next, Jerry in Pennsylvania. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Leo. Before we start, how's the audio? Do you have a hum?
Yeah, it's a little hum in it, but that's all right. I understand. What's going on?
Let me move away. Leo, I've got a new laptop with a horrible Windows 10 in it, and I'm just going
to... Yeah?
And I plugged a mouse in there, a wireless mouse with a little bitty dongle. It worked great. All of a sudden, one day, it stopped working. So I try a different mouse. Doesn't work. Take the mice downstairs, it's a different computer. There's no problem. So I had to bring up an old Microsoft mouse with a receiver the size of a hockey puck.
Yeah.
I plugged it in. It works great.
Yeah.
Where should I look for my problem at, Leo?
Well, wireless mice have problems in all sorts of areas. The dongle, I presume, plugs into the USB port, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so if the wireless mouse is working, and of course the first thing I do is check the batteries.
Well, they work great in my other computer.
Okay, so as long as the batteries are okay. And that's one of the reasons I don't like wireless mice, because they fail. And they fail, of course, when you need the mouse the most. But as long as the batteries are okay, the dongle should make that mouse look exactly like the wired mouse to your computer, because the dongle is a USB interface for a mouse. And Logitech makes these. I presume it's Logitech. They're easily the most popular. It's just a little thing you put in the USB port, and then the mouse communicates with that, and then that communicates with the computer. In Logitech's case, they do have software. So the first thing I would do, just to see if everything's working, is to... That's, of course, important step two. Did it join the Wi-Fi fine?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just logging into your Amazon account you can't do. Is that right?
Yeah, because the remote locks up.
Yeah.
And I've replaced the batteries and...
You might just have a bad one. I don't know what's wrong with it. I've never had this problem happen. Not sure why it's a problem. When you get a Fire TV, it's set up to work with your Amazon account already. So all it's asking you to do is confirm that this is you, log in, and it uses your Amazon account because, of course, if you have Amazon Prime, you get Prime movies and all of that stuff. So it does need that information. That's kind of how a Fire TV works. It's really why it's designed. You know, it's designed to be an Amazon product. If the remote locks up, you can, I believe, I'm trying to remember if the Fire Stick will do this. Maybe the chat room will help me. I think the Fire Stick may be able to work with an external Bluetooth keyboard. Nevertheless, even if you could, I wouldn't suggest it because it sounds like there's something wrong with the remote. So, now remember, there can be delays, but I don't think that that's it. I think it's time to call Amazon. And they, you know what? The good thing about this is they'll send you a new one in about 5 seconds. You'll send the old one back, of course, but they'll send you a new one before you even send the old one back. And I think you should do this because even if we could get around this problem, this is not good. There's something wrong with it. Any suggestions, though? I don't use the Fire Stick. I was very tempted. They had a real deal yesterday on the new Fire TV dongle. It's like a Fire Stick, but it's a little bigger. It's 4K. I think it was $35. Normally like $60, $70. I thought, oh, I should get that. But frankly, I've had an Amazon Fire TV sitting on my shelf for a year or two. I just never got around to setting it up. I have enough stuff. Chatroom is suggesting, and this is a workaround, but there is a Fire Stick app for your smartphone. If you have a smartphone, put that on there and pair it to your Fire Stick. You can use a smartphone instead of a remote. Maybe you're willing to just get rid of, maybe the remote isn't important to you. If you can do it on the phone, then that would be a workaround that might work for you. But you should have a remote that works, frankly. Florida, David on the line. Hi, David.
Hello, Leo. Thank you for having me on air this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling. I detect a little Baltimore, Philly, Mid-Atlantic accent in there.
Well, Mid-Atlantic, Philly is absolutely correct.
All right.
Absolutely correct.
Right.
I'm loving it here in Florida for the past 15 years. I'm on what we call the nature coast down here along the Gulf of Mexico. Just beautiful.
A snowbird. You know, I've wanted to go down there. I've thought about retiring there many times. You don't mind the humidity?
I don't find the humidity any worse than it was back in the Philadelphia area.
Yes, you're right.
To be honest with you.
And the giant bugs, you can live with those.
No, we got snakes that eat the bugs, so that's not a problem.
And then the gators eat the snakes, so really it's good all around.
It's a big circle. You don't have to shovel the snow, Leo. You don't have to.
Oh, I know that one. And I bet your friends in Philly are not having a good time this winter. Oh, man.
No, they don't want to hear from me anymore. They're tired.
Last 4 weeks. Now, Toby, what can I do for you?
It's beautiful here today.
Oh, I bet. Well,
listen, Leo, I listen to you every week, and you have an amazing program, and I go out to the website. And to be honest with you, at my age, even though I'm a ham radio operator for many years and done computers and all that sort of thing, a lot of what goes on these days goes right over my head.
It's hard. You know, it's hard for me to keep up. I spend every minute, every waking hour paying attention,
yeah.
And I still have a hard time keeping up.
Yeah. Well, I'm jealous when I hear that you absolutely, because of business, have to buy the absolute most current stuff. You know?
What can I say? Yeah. I have to.
Yep. Well, I'm stuck with an old Samsung smartphone, a J3, I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
Oh,
that
yeah.
works fine.
That's fine.
That's
yeah.
fine for me.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm calling about something that's not nearly as high-tech as what you've been talking about for the past hour.
Okay.
And this is a problem that I keep coming up with, and it seems to me it's a very simplistic problem, but I run into it every day.
What's the problem?
Here's the problem. I use AOL. I use Avast. I use MSN, Bing, Mozilla Firefox, Google Chrome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone wants to know if they should save the passwords that I use.
Say no.
So, well, I'm dumb enough that I would say, yeah, that'll make my life easier.
Yeah.
Well, I finally figured out, even though all of my passwords have 12 to 18 characters, you know, make them complex and everything else, so I got to save them because I'll be darned if I can remember them.
Right.
I do write them down.
Right.
I just replaced, about 3 months ago, replaced an old 7-year-old Lenovo with an HP Envy desktop, model 750.
Very nice. Good choice.
514.
Yeah.
Got 128 gigs solid state drive, a terabyte hard drive, and Windows 10,
yada. So what's the problem? LaPorte, the tech guy. I won't try to figure out why Michael Cozzi was playing that one. He often sends me coded messages, you know. But just a word of caution. He is not sending you coded messages, okay? He's not. I promise. Right, Michael? Not them, just me. Kim Schaffer's also been answering the phones. Thank you, Kim. Doing a great job. We're going to keep Kim working a little extra this next hour. I'm going to keep answering calls. We got about half an hour left of the show, but we are pre-recording calls for future use. So if you would like to get through, don't stop calling when we get to the top of the hour. Keep it going. 8888 Ask Leo. Garth in Neenah, Wisconsin. Hello, Garth.
Hello, Leo. How are you today?
I am well. How are you?
Well, I'm a little bit confused. About 6 or 8 weeks ago, I turned my phone on first thing in the morning. All of a sudden, it started downloading information. And it was the telephone number and address and everything of my second cousin. And I haven't seen or heard from him in 30 years. And it loaded everything. His telephone number, cell phone, landline, street
address. You mean it added that information to your contact list?
Yes.
Okay. So
where did it come from in the first place?
Well, let me go a couple of steps back here and say something that's, I think, important for everybody to understand, which is that computers, and your phone is a computer, and technology in general, may sometimes appear to do things without rhyme or reason. They may appear mysterious, almost, in fact, magical. In fact, like is there a ghost in the machine? But let me promise you, having really delved deeply, looked very hard, there is nothing magical in any of these boxes. In fact, the truth is, it's all pretty straightforward and simple. Computers simulate intelligence. They don't actually show intelligence and will or anything. They simulate it by doing simple, simple, simple things like addition and subtraction very, very, very fast. And if you do it fast enough, you can actually look like you know what you're doing. But ultimately, there's always a determinist. I use the word deterministic, and that's a big word. But that's the best word for this. There's always a deterministic reason, a real cause and effect for why computers technology does what it does. There's no voodoo. There's no magic. It's doing it for a reason. Now, I'm going to speculate on the reasons why it's doing this, and there are a couple of them. One of the things smartphone contact lists often do is go out onto your social networks. They won't do it without your permission, but the problem is, you know, they ask for permission quickly and sometimes subtly, and you may not have noticed that's what you're doing. But my guess is that your contact list is looking at your Facebook profile, for instance. Maybe your second cousin's on Facebook, or your Twitter profile, or your LinkedIn profile. I, in fact, you know, intentionally, with purpose, connect all of my contact lists to those services because that way I get updated phone numbers, updated addresses. In many cases, I get pictures. You know, I don't have pictures of all my contacts, but all my contacts will post their picture on social media. So as a result, my contact list pulls that in, and now I've got a picture, which is nice because when they call, I see a picture of them. So this is a convenience factor. There's a secret, hidden, less talked about reason why they do this. They want that information too. And this is, you know, something we are now, thanks to the attention being paid to Facebook, becoming more aware of. Almost everything on your phone, every application, the operating system itself, the companies that make the phone, the companies that make the operating system, the cell phone carriers that provide the service, almost every single one of those. In fact, I'm going to take the word almost out. Every single one of those wants more information about you because they can make money on it. In fact, we talk a lot about Facebook invading your privacy. Facebook's nothing compared to your internet service provider. Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, they've all sold information about their customers to the highest bidder. Every one of them. Every one of them. And every app on your phone, with few exceptions, every phone manufacturer, Samsung, Apple, yes, Apple, they all want your information so they can sell it. So contact managers and a lot of other applications will always say, hey, you know, life would be better if you'd give us your Facebook login or your Google login or whatever login. So almost certainly that information, your phone isn't smart enough. Trust me, it's just a box of rocks. It's working really fast. Your phone isn't smart enough to figure out, oh, that's a second cousin. I better get that information. It's doing something you asked it to do, whether you remember it or not. And almost certainly it's getting that information from one of your social networks because that's a nice feature, right? And of course, the more addresses, the more phone numbers, the more information they have, the more money they can make. And this is what we saw Facebook doing. And this is why so many people have decided to delete Facebook. DeleteFacebook.com if you'd like to find out how. DeleteFacebook.com. I'm doing it. Because Facebook's entire business model from day one, from Mark Zuckerberg as a Harvard freshman when he wrote the program, he may say, I think life is better when people are connected. And I bet he believes it even. But he never charged for anything on Facebook. You know why? He didn't have to. Because even as a Harvard freshman, he knew there's value in the information I'm getting from people. The stuff they're voluntarily giving me, where they live. You know what the most valuable thing that you're giving Facebook? It's not your address or your birth date. It's your Facebook likes. Do you know how much information people can deduce, can learn from your Facebook likes? I had promised to talk about this. Let me see if I can find the article. This goes back a few years to research done on by a university psychology department. They were curious about what they could learn from something that was publicly available, information that people gave out publicly. Turns out, I don't know if you know this, but your likes on Facebook, the pages, the brands, the posts that you like are publicly available. Facebook wants them to be public available. In fact, Facebook makes money, lots of it, on selling that information to the highest bidder, particularly advertisers, but not always. Could be Russia. So what you like can be surprisingly accurately can be an indicator to who you are. For instance, there's mathematical models, and they've done this, and one of the reasons this happens is because we've gotten very good. One of the things computers are really good at is manipulating mass quantities of data very, very quickly and finding correlations, connections between the data. So that's what happened, is they found connections between your likes and who you are. You can actually find out more about this. They created an app called You Are What You Like. This is, guess what? Guess who did this? The University of Cambridge. Oh, yeah, the folks behind Cambridge Analytica. You take a simple psychology quiz. They collect your likes, because actually the real thing they get is your Facebook profile. And they can determine things like your race, your religion, your sexual orientation with massive accuracy. Did you know that people with high IQs, like the Colbert Report, this is old, right? The Godfather to Kill a Mockingbird, lower IQ people like Harley Davidson, Bret Michaels, the rock band Poison. I'm gonna give you some of these. I'm going to find some of these. We're giving that information away for free. Anyway, to answer your question, I'm sure you're connected to your contact list of Facebook. Leo,
you actually cook food. I mean,
I actually cook food. I don't just eat it. I cook it.
You cook it.
Then I eat it.
Yeah. So I like this just from boiling water. All right.
Okay.
So it's a new line of cookware. It is used in industry and mainly restaurants. It's called Turbo Pot Cookware.
Not Instapot, but Turbo Pot.
Turbo Pot.
It's not quite as fast as Instant Pot.
Well, Instant Pot, wasn't that the thing that you could charge USB gadgets with?
No, that was a good one, though. That was something you put on your campfire that would boil the water and charge your phone.
And charge your phone.
So what is the Turbo Pot?
Oh, okay, so Turbo Pot is, on electronics, they use heat sinks to draw the heat away from the works.
Right.
So Turbo Pot makes heat sinks that are fins that attach to the bottom of their stainless steel pots.
Ooh.
And it actually increases the amount of heat going into the pot. And I took a 7.5 inch.
You know, it's funny. I mean, pots haven't changed in 1,000 years.
Exactly. So this is great fun. I took a regular saucepan. I had an 8 inch and I had a 7.5 inch turbo pot. And I adjusted the flame and I used one of those non-contact thermometers to get the flame about the same temperature.
Yeah, you just aim the thing.
Yeah, exactly. And the turbo pot boiled a cup of water in a minute.
Yeah.
And the other pot took almost 2 minutes.
Wow. If my calculations are correct, twice as fast.
Right. Well, they say 30 to 50 times faster. And
that's a little more than twice as fast, but okay.
Yeah. And they have some videos on their website done by PG&E. And as
now,
a matter of fact,
this only works with gas, or does it work?
I was just going to say that. Only on gas, not electric, not induction.
Yeah.
And, California is very advanced. Some gas companies are starting to offer rebates for people who buy.
Well, I have a gas stove. I'm going to have to get me some turbo stuff.
Turbo stuff.
Nice cookware? I mean, they have non-skid,
industrial strength non-skid. The saucepan's all stainless, really nice, and not expensive. The saucepan is $49. The frying pan, I believe, is $44.
They have it. Have it on Amazon.
Amazon.
Your website.
It's so funny. Three days ago, it wasn't on Amazon, so they're just coming into the home consumer market.
I'm going to order a few turbo pots.
Okay.
Yeah, or as we say in France, turbo pose.
Boy, you are. You just know everything about it. The thing you really broke my heart when you said earlier that there's no magic inside electronic components.
Yes, I know. Isn't that depressing?
Gosh.
We thought there was some magic in there. No.
I don't call tech help. I light incense.
How do you clean the bottom of the turbo pose?
You know what? The turbo pot, the company says that the pot is designed so that anything dripping down will go under the pot and will not go into the fins. So I'm taking your word on that, because boiling water does not leave a lot of residue if it overflows.
That's safe. Yeah. All right. I'm going to get some, turbo pots. So they have, they're not horribly expensive. An 8-quart stock pot, which could be hundreds of dollars if you got the fancy stuff, is only $79. And they got a $44 10-inch nonstick frying pan. That's pretty good.
Yeah, well, I admire you because you know what to put in those kind of pots.
Yeah, water. Lots of boiling water.
That's the only recipe I have. Please don't steal it.
I boil my water with a recipe I got from Dick DiBartolo.
Yes, yeah, so he got it from his mother.
Yes.
Generation.
It's the best boiled water you'll have. Thank you, Dickie D. If you go to gizwiz.biz, that's his website, gizwiz.biz, and click the GizWiz Visits the Tech Guy, you'll see a link to the Turbo Po and a video that Dick shot, his famous, world-famous one-take theater.
Yes, exactly.
He's too lazy to do a second take.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And, too, yeah.
And while you're there, play the What the Heck Is It contest, a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. All you have to do is identify a close-up picture of a gizmo or gadget. Do we have another month before this ends, or is it
the end of April.
End of April, okay. So hie thee hither, gizwiz.biz. Don't forget Dick's great podcast, gizwiz.tv, for the GizWiz program. Thank you, Dickie D.
Thank you, sir. You're a gentleman.
You just cost me a couple $100. I'm going to buy me some turbo pots. I was thinking about buying a convection top, but or induction top, one of those. But I'd have to buy new pots for that, but these wouldn't work with it. So
no.
Maybe I'll save $1,000 on the new stovetop and just get some turbo pots.
There you go.
Thanks to you. Thanks to
you.
Okay,
pal.
Thank you, Dickie D. Our show today and always brought to you by my friends at Carbonite, the guys for backup for home and for office. And lately, I have to say, we've really been talking a lot about Carbonite solutions for business. They really have become the data protection platform for business. High availability backup. Data migration, so you never locked into a cloud. Cloud and hybrid backup. I like that because you can back up locally, which takes no time, uses no bandwidth, but then at night back up to the cloud, so you get the best of both worlds. Quick restores and rock-solid data protection. The latest Carbonite Recover, really interesting. They call it disaster recovery as a service. It keeps your critical systems online with, and this is important for business, less so at home, but for business with near zero downtime. You know, every minute of downtime is revenue lost in business, revenue you may never get back. So it's important to get back online fast. Carbonite Recover offers push-button cloud failover with RTOs measured in minutes. Your data is always current because it's constantly synchronized with the source. Recovery points are never more than a few seconds old. It's engineered for complex IT environments. No matter how fancy your IT department made everything, you've got orchestration for multiple-tier applications. You've got automation and custom script points. No matter how complex your use case across your enterprise might be. And of course, data is continuously replicated at the byte level and 256-bit AES encrypted to make sure it's private and safe in flight and at rest. Carbonite. Find out more about Carbonite Recover and all the Carbonite data protection platform tools at one place, carbonite.com. C-A-R-B-O-N-I-T-E. You got to back it up to get it back. Do it right at carbonite.com. We're going to take another call before the end of the show, but I promise you, if you're on the line, we will get to you. We're going to continue to take calls after the show ends, so keep the phones going at 8888-ASK-LEO. I've got some recording to do for time off in the future. You can help me out a little bit. Call and ask your question, like Andre from Irvine, California. Hello, Andre.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for calling.
Doing well. Just a nice Saturday with the kids.
Nice. What can I do to help you with your technology? Yeah, I hear them. Yeah.
I have a couple Nest house.
Okay.
And I heard you talking about the Internet of Things.
Yeah, Nest, the good news about Nest, they're a Google company. They are, in fact, they were one of the first to do automatic updates. You probably noticed your Nest updates from time to time.
Yeah. My question was, the way I connected them to my wireless router was I had created a guest network for guests that come to the house.
Yep.
And I connected the Nest to the guest network. And I was curious, is that any more secure than...
unfortunately not. Because when somebody's on your network as a guest, even though they don't know your password, they do have access to your entire network. And that's the problem with any IoT device we were talking about at the beginning of the show, is that once they're on your network, a bad guy who could hack the... Now, the good thing is the Nest is secure. I have no issues with the Nest. But if they could hack the Nest, even though it's a guest on your network, they'd get access to the whole network. There are some devices, my Plume does this, that offer an internet-only guest network. But the best way, well, and I don't necessarily recommend this, is using VLANs. Some sophisticated routers will do that, or multiple, three routers. I think you're fine. I think the truth is, get a device like Nest that updates and keep it up to date. That's the best solution. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.